Hello. This episode of the Bokomi podcast was recorded before Dominic Cummings resigned as chief advisor to the British Prime Minister.
Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Bokomi. We're here to get smarter, faster, together with original, memorable insights. That's OMI from new non-fiction books by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology and culture. In this episode...
Hello, my name is Patrick Barwise, co-author of The War Against the BBC... And this is my OMI for Book OMI.
We meet the Emeritus Professor of Management and Marketing at London Business School, who wants us to stand up for the BBC before it loses a war waged by right-wing lobbyists, free market economists and competitors who frame the corporation as biased, bloated, elite and out of touch.
Most people don't realise the scale of the threat and the nature of the threat. And if and when they do understand the scale and nature of this threat, most people in this country will be very indignant and will join forces to stop it happening.
In The War Against the BBC, Patrick Barwise and his co-author Peter York trace a line of anti-BBC gunpowder back to a surprisingly small but powerful and determined cabal of lobbyists and politicians linked to media and business interests in the UK and America.
What Cummings thinks about the media system we should have in the UK, including the BBC, is not a secret because he actually wrote it in 2004. Essentially, what he was proposing was a media ecology similar to the American one, which has given us this hugely divided nation. And the four-point plan consisted, number one, of attacking and undermining the BBC wherever possible.
How did this happen? Has the BBC become too big for its own boots, losing sight of its original purpose to inform, educate and entertain? Or is it just time for us to accept that all great things must come to an end? Patrick Barwise, welcome to Bokomi.
Glad to join you, Rich.
What's motivating you personally to defend the BBC and why now?
Well, I've worked on consumer and audience behaviour for many, many years, all my academic life since the 1970s, and from time to time started to get involved in policy issues. I did the original revenue forecast for Channel 4 in 1979. And then one thing that I've thought about over the last 10 years or so is the long-term threats to the BBC, mainly through limiting its funding. I was discussing this with Peter York because the two of us do an annual prize giving for the Market Research Society. And in between those sessions, I discovered that Peter too has very strong views on this issue. So in the last few years, we've seen a ramping up of the war against the BBC. So we decided to join forces and write a book about it. And our motivation is simply that we care. And we think that most people don't realise the scale of the threat and the nature of the threat. And if and when they do understand the scale and nature of this threat, most people in this country will be very indignant and will join forces to stop it happening.
You want to stoke up some form of rage in the reader and in the British public.
Well, it's interesting because we've had to try and strike a balance. There's a great deal of sort of data and analysis in the book. In order to keep it, you know, reasonably readable, we've tried to do all three of the things that Lord Reith set as the mission for the BBC: to inform, to educate, we've tried to entertain, but we've also tried to enrage the readers a bit. So this is not, I hope, a rant. We're a sort of a little bit of an oil and water mix. So we complement each other.
It is an incredibly good read, actually. And you can tell.
Thank you.
You're welcome. There's a balance between that flourish. Peter has a flourish, doesn't he, in his prose and a certain style, which is an unusual combination because normally a book of this nature will be a kind of rant with some facts. But there's a hell of a lot of emotion in the book and flourish, but there's almost as many footnotes as prose because you want to back everything up with evidence and fact. So for the purposes of balance, I'm going to present some of the arguments against the BBC because there are many and they filtered into the mainstream, starting with why is it not possible for the BBC to fund the license fee for the over 75s?
Well, the amount of money involved for the over 75s, meaning every household with one or more people aged 75 plus, regardless of household size or income. So that includes households which have three people of working age bringing in lots of money. It includes retired investment bankers and so on. It was completely badly targeted. The full cost of paying for all of those free licenses, which is a welfare benefit and should be funded, if we have it, should be funded out of general taxation. The full cost is $750 million a year. Now, the total public funding of the BBC now is just over $3 billion a year, and that is 30% lower than 10 years ago. If the BBC's public funding had simply kept pace with general inflation since 2010, it would be nearly 1.4 billion higher, and then it would be able to do that. But it's starting from a base where its funding has been deeply, deeply cut in the last 10 years. And it's now reached a point where, if it were to take on the full cost of free licenses for every home with an over 75, it would have to cut down major services. Now, there are things people find that hard to believe. And the two things they say is, isn't the BBC very inefficient and wasteful? But when it's audited independently by the National Audit Office, the BBC's overhead level is actually slightly below the average for the industry. It's done a great job softening the blow of this 30% funding cut since 2010, because not only has it become more and more efficient, but also it's generating more and more revenue through its commercial activities. And the guy who was running that is Tim Davey, who's just taken over as the new director general. But we're now reaching the limit. The thing which people tend to pick out is Gary Lineker and the other presenters. And my personal view is that Tim Davey should be letting some of those people go or getting their agents to accept much lower rate of pay. It won't actually make any practical difference, but it will make a difference in terms of people's perception. So the way the numbers work are that if you reduced the pay of every presenter who's currently paid more than 150,000, which is, I'm afraid, well below the market rate for that kind of talent, what the commercial people are paying. But if you did that, then the total saving would be about 20 million a year, which is 3% of the total cost of free licenses for all households with over 75. So the people saying, sack Gary Lineker, how are you going to pay for the other 97% of the cost of this thing? It simply can't be done. The numbers don't add up.
The way I read it, and you talk about perception there, the way I read it was that it was almost part of a plan to undermine the BBC in government, was to give them this kind of hospital pass, this PR hospital pass that would damage them 5 or 6 years, 10 years down the line, by making out that they were withdrawing the funding of something that people saw and suddenly felt entitled to, which raises the issue and the perception and the questions that you've just covered then about talent costs and wastage and bloating. Am I reading too much into it?
I don't think you're reading too much into it, but in order to see what's going on, you have to wind back to the year 2000, when free TV licenses for all households with over 75s was introduced by Gordon Brown when he was Chancellor. And it was the very last thing in his budget announcement, and it was clearly highly political. Now, this was a year in which the regular old age pension was going up by rather a small amount. And so everyone interpreted this as a gimmick to try and keep the grey vote despite the pension not going up very much. And he said, we, the government, will pay for a free TV licence for every household with someone aged 75 plus. Now, the BBC rather welcomed it, which some of us thought was a mistake at the time, because, first of all, it was clear that with an ageing population, the cost would become higher and higher. It's not very well targeted, because there are a lot of very prosperous older people and a lot of much poorer and more vulnerable younger people, single parents and so on. And so it was pretty badly targeted. The big problem was that it was a kind of unexploded time bomb under the BBC, because at some point a future chancellor might come along and try and land it on the BBC. And that is exactly what happened in the first instance in 2010, when George Osborne tried to land it on the BBC in an outrageous process behind closed doors, and, you know, with a baseball bat, a metaphorical baseball bat. And to their great credit, the then chairman and director general of the BBC said they would resign if he pushed it through, and he backed down. Wind forward to 2015, and a new director general and a new chair, and he, this is Osborne, did exactly the same thing again, and they accepted it. And I still don't know why they accepted it. I think they were quite wrong to accept it. The process, which had been highly criticised in 2010, was criticised again in 2015. George Osborne had six secret meetings with either Rupert Murdoch or Rupert Murdoch executives during the few weeks after the 2015 election and this announcement. So he consulted Rupert Murdoch thoroughly. He did not consult the British people. He did not consult the British Parliament. And we are now living with the consequences of that, in which there are no good options other than this or some future government doing the right thing and saying, if we are to have free TV licenses merely because someone in the household is 75 plus, then it should be paid for out of general taxation because it's a welfare benefit. And those people who have a problem with that, why are they not saying that the electricity and gas companies should pay for free heating, you know, the winter fuel allowance for old age pensioners, because it's a welfare benefit, so why should they pay? Exactly the same argument applies for the TV licence, free TV licence.
You were chair of the consumer organisation, which, until 2015, is that right?
That's correct.
Looking through the lens of the consumer, do you think the BBC represents value for a limited purse of money when we need to be spending more on the NHS, for instance?
It's a fair comparison. It is actually one we make towards the end of the book, because both of these are sort of national treasures. I would again fight in a ditch to protect the NHS from its enemies, who quite often are the same people as the BBC's enemies. There are two huge differences. One of them is the NHS's problems are overwhelmingly due to things like COVID and the growth of so-called lifestyle diseases and obesity and all of that. They're not because of people deliberately attacking them. The second difference is an enormous difference in scale. In terms of public funding, the NHS is 50 times bigger than the BBC. You should shut down the BBC, keep the license fee and transfer the money to the NHS. It would be a rounding error in terms of the NHS budget. It's 43 pence per household per day. All right. That is very, very little.
Even if I'm not using it at all because I just want to watch Netflix, why should I have to pay for the BBC as well?
Well, the first thing I'd say is if you've got Netflix, you're not one of the poorest people, because it means you've got Netflix, you've got an online TV, and you've got a decent broadband link. So you're clearly not one of the people who's sort of seriously struggling with the 43 pence per day. The other thing is those people who've said, why should you pay for the BBC if you don't use it, have never come forward with any evidence that such people actually exist. So this is an argument in principle, also applies to a lot of other taxation and public services. So, I mean, people who don't have kids pay vastly more than the license fee for our schools and universities and so on. So, you know, the idea that you only pay taxes if you directly benefit, that's simply not the system. And, you know, those other costs are much, much, much higher than 43 pence per day. But the other thing is essentially this population of households that have to pay the annual license fee and don't get any benefit from the BBC services. There's no evidence that they exist essentially at all. And we do have some indirect evidence on this. The only time we've ever collected proper data on household usage of the BBC over a week, it was 99%. So the idea that there's a significant number of people who over the course of a whole year are not getting any benefit from the BBC is clearly a myth. So there's a lot of mythologizing about all this.
Entertainment is often argued and debated about. It touches lots of people's lives. It's the most popular element of the BBC's. It's part of its purpose to entertain. What's about the argument that the public are now super served by commercially funded entertainment, by a market on every screen and every device. So in terms of entertainment, the entertainment product, what's so different about the BBC that we need to pay for that as well? The Voice now sits happily on ITV. Bake Off pitched its marquee on Channel 4. Shouldn't we just let the market take care of the content and we'll get what we want?
That's not really what the majority of the public think. Basically, what most of the public want is more good programmes. They don't want more bad programmes. They want more good programmes, and they actually welcome the choice. Bake Off is, of course, a lovely example, because those people who think that the BBC should only do things that no commercial company would ever do have an interesting sort of problem with Bake Off, because Bake Off is, as we all know, it's a baking competition with amateur bakers. And when it was launched, the initial reviews were absolutely dire, because people said, you know, why would anyone want to watch a baking competition? We then know it went from strength to strength because people cared passionately, and it became the number one program in Britain. It's the number one program on Channel 4 now as well. And looking backwards, we can see there's a lot of drama, there's a lot of tension, you know, there's human interest. There are lots of reasons why this is a popular program. That was not obvious in advance. So when it was first proposed, it took them 5 years to get anyone to back it, to get it commissioned, the independent company which developed it. They had great difficulty getting the presenters to agree to do it, because it sounded just like an archetypical public service program, which was very worthy, but nobody would watch. And according to this rather mad Alice in Wonderland logic, once it became a blockbuster, and it's shown all around the world, and its versions of it are franchised all around the world, according to this rather strange logic, because it was then sort of competitive against ITV and Sky, the BBC should have stopped it. And this is completely mad. And it's not just me who thinks it's mad, it's the public who think this mad. So when the then minister, John Whittingdale, commissioned research into, you know, should the BBC, you know, show entertainment programmes as well as news and current affairs and documentaries, the public not only overwhelmingly said yes, but when they ran focus groups about it, you know, they sort of had to have the question explained a second time, because it seemed such a batty question. So the test case would be, strictly, should the BBC now, that Strictly is clearly very popular, should the BBC stop showing Strictly? And, you know, you would not get very wide support from the public for that, to me, completely batty idea.
Would the public care if it was seen on Sky or if it was seen on ITV, just as with The Voice? Do, in terms of your research and your opinion, does it matter where the content is shown or who produces it?
Not necessarily, but we're talking about a creative product. And so what you want is creative competition. So more people are coming up with more ideas. This one actually sounded a rather bizarre idea. So both Bake Off and Strictly are BBC ideas, which were then, they're made by independent. You know, in a creative industry, what you want is more good ideas. The market will determine which ideas people like. Coming to your question of supposing we then said, now that we know that Strictly is popular, we must stop the BBC from showing it. Then if it were forced to make it available so that it ended up on ITV, I don't think that would be a disaster. In general, the public prefers not to have programmes interrupted by commercials, but that's not a sort of very big thing. If it were on Sky, that would certainly be very unpopular, because it would mean that it was only available to people subscribing to Sky. And one of the things about Strictly is it's something which is very widely shared in terms of, you know, conversations between people and who's going to survive next week and all of those things. So if it ended up on Sky or on Netflix or anything you have to subscribe to, then I think there would be a very large loss of public value. If it ended up on free-to-air commercial TV, I think it would be marginally irritating. But I also think, because of the commercial breaks, but I also think it would be hugely unfair on the BBC.
So let's move into informing the public. Talking of news and current affairs, huge at the moment, where we need a unbiased reporting. But the BBC is often accused of liberal bias, of being staffed by liberal metropolitan elites. How can you accuse what is obviously the most trusted service for news and information on the planet? How can it be accused of liberal bias?
That's a very good question. And of course, the people you should be directing it to are the people making that accusation. I think that there was an article by Michael Deacon in the Telegraph, which compared people's reaction to the BBC News to football supporters' reactions to the referee, where, you know, most people have a tendency to think the referee is biased against their own side. And if you look at the data from the general public, then that is exactly what you find, that the BBC is seen as left-wing by people who tend towards the right and also more by older people, whereas younger people and people who tend towards the left tend to see the BBC as establishment and biased towards the right and pro-business and so on. There is a different situation. You look at the scale of organised attacks against the BBC, which are overwhelmingly from the right, right-wing think tanks, including there's a specialist organization called Newswatch, which very few people have actually heard of, and its funding is obscure, but it is relentlessly issuing reports saying that the BBC's coverage of Brexit and the EU is anti-Brexit and pro-EU. Those reports from think tanks and so on are well-funded. There are lots of them, and they are then disseminated particularly in the newspapers, and the British national newspapers are still heavily skewed towards the right. Now, because of the internet, the newspaper industry is under threat. The circulation, the revenue is not what it was, but they have a huge role in setting the agenda for everyone else. So I think that there's an interesting sort of explanation of why we have this disconnect between the fact that the public sees the BBC as the most trusted news source, and some think it's a bit left-wing, some think it's a bit right-wing, but the organised attacks are overwhelmingly from the right, which is better resourced and has more outlets.
Well, let's talk about the motives of the generals waging war on the BBC as you see it. In particular, the Daily Mail online under the relatively middle-class Paul Dacre and the royally connected Geordie Gregg. What's motivating them?
Well, the short answer is, of course, I don't know. You'd have to ask them. I would actually make a distinction between Dacre and Gregg. I mean, in the case of Dacre, it was clearly a sort of visceral thing. I think he has given us a few clues in things that he's said. There's a very strong, purely ideological aspect to this. I have, in a sense, some sympathy with this. I mean, as former chairman of Which, I believe in competition. I'm a marketing professor. I believe in competitive markets. The idea that media should have to sort of fight for their support and the BBC, you know, gets the license fee. Now, it's not the case that the BBC simply gets the license fee automatically. I mean, it's been reduced and reduced and reduced since 2010. But he hated The Guardian and the BBC and called them the subsidiariat. So there's a sort of ideological aspect of that. He was a hugely successful newspaper editor through an intuitive understanding of his readers. It was, you know, the founder of the Daily Mail over 100 years ago who said the British people like a great hero and they like a great hate. And so, you know, on the left, the nickname for the Daily Mail is the Daily Hate. And the idea is, you know, you start the day at breakfast getting angry about something. One interpretation is it's ideological. Another interpretation is that it sells newspapers. And the third interpretation is, of course, the Daily Mail is Tory supporting and therefore attacks the BBC, because I'm quite sure that sincerely in Paul Dacre's mind, the BBC is left-wing and anti-Tory.
If the BBC is so good at programme making and creativity, why not just charge a subscription or take advertising and be done with it?
Well, that's a very good question. And my personal view is that the licence fee is not the right way to fund the BBC in the long term. Not because people have to pay it whether they watch the BBC or not, because I don't think those people exist. But because linking the funding of the BBC to the ownership of a TV set or even any other specific device, I think that's a becoming an out-of-date way of funding the BBC. I don't think it's a sort of urgent issue, but over the next 5-10 years, I think we should be moving beyond a device-specific tax like that. The grown-up question is, what are the practical alternatives? I think that we needn't spend very long looking at advertising. Advertising was looked at in the 1980s in great detail. Funding the BBC by advertising might change its priorities because it would be chasing advertisers rather than the range of programmes that viewers want as citizens as well as consumers. And the great majority of its advertising revenue would come from advertising funded media. I think the more serious option now is to look at subscriptions. And we now have a DG who's commercial. He says, you know, if we were forced to fund ourselves by subscriptions, we would, I think, make a great success of it. So the question is not whether it's feasible to fund the BBC by subscriptions, but whether it's a good idea. Supposing you could wave a magic wand and tomorrow everybody has conditional access, then the question is this in the public interest? And I think there are two kinds of reason why it wouldn't be in the public interest. The first is the BBC ceases to be universal, and immediately you're switching to a two-tier system where you've got haves and have-nots. And in general, it means that poorer people aren't able to get the BBC, or maybe they get a very reduced service or something like that. And that is clearly divisive. The idea of sort of dividing our country, you know, is pretty bad. But the other reason, which I think people haven't picked up enough, is that the actual subscription price, if you wanted to maintain the investment in programs that we currently have, the subscription price would need to be much, much higher than the current license fee. And there are two reasons for that. The first is, obviously, if you have a subscription, not everybody subscribes, and the people who do subscribe would each have to pay more to compensate for the ones not subscribing. What's less obvious is that subscription is a very, very expensive system to run, because you need to spend far more on marketing than the BBC currently spends. You need to put equipment into people's homes or something similar. If you look at Sky, which is a very well-run organization, then the amount that Sky spends on sales and general administration is roughly the same as the complete program budget of BBC television, all right? And that's a fixed cost. Once people start looking at the numbers, they will be quite horrified that essentially we move to a two-tier system which half of the country, or maybe less than half of the country, no longer have the BBC, and everybody else has to pay at least 50% more than the license fee. So why would that be a good idea? One of the ironies is that if the BBC were funded, if we said if the BBC were funded by advertising, then that would clearly have a very bad impact on Channel 4 and ITV and Channel 5 and so on. But if the BBC were funded by subscriptions, it would be a direct competitor for revenue against Sky and Virgin, and that would actually be bad for pay TV as well.
So back to the war. This is, for me, was like uncovering a stone that I didn't even know existed. It's an area around a single postcode, really, in London, and a single house, 55 Tufton Street, containing a kind of special operations executive, a collection of alt-right-leaning lobby groups, Civitas, Leave Means Leave, the New Culture Forum, the Taxpayers Alliance, different rooms under the same roof. And then down the street, you've got the Adam Smith Institute, the Institute of Economic Affairs. What do they all have in common, apart from nice offices?
They have more than one thing in common, actually. The hatred of the BBC is part of it. Climate change scepticism is part of it. And being very pro-Brexit. So those three things correlate. They also have in common that they don't like being described as right-wing think tanks. And of course, when you use terms like right-wing or liberal, there's a degree of ambiguity about that. So you have to say what you mean. I think that those of us who do describe them as right-wing think tanks, what we mean is that it doesn't matter what the question is, the answer is always the same. The answer is always less government, lower taxes, more market. And that doesn't mean they're always wrong. I absolutely don't think they're always wrong. I think, for instance, some of the privatizations that were encouraged by the Adam Smith Institute when Margaret Thatcher first became prime minister were absolutely right, and contracting out of dustbin collection and all those sorts of things. But for people like me, who are very sort of fanatically evidence-based, what you have to do is look at each of these issues in its own right and decide based on the evidence, you know, what's the right policy. Whereas what these think tanks have in common is that the answer's always the same. The other thing they have in common is dark money funding. And so they're extremely shy about telling us who's funding them. But what we do know, because there is some evidence on this, is quite a lot of the funding is coming from the US. And they're also very close to the much, much bigger and even more powerful right-wing think tanks in the US, which started sooner and which get a lot of funding from people, particularly the fossil fuel industry, funds a lot of the US right-wing think tanks.
One of the key figures in the Tufton Street gang is Matthew Elliott, who founded the Taxpayers Alliance, Big Brother Watch, and the Conservative Friends of Russia in 2012. He also founded Vote Leave in 2015, working with Dominic Cummings on their successful campaign. So someone who has a direct working relationship with the Prime Minister's chief advisor has a personal commercial interest in dismantling the BBC. Do you think people know or even care about that connection?
They certainly don't know. I think that a lot of people would care. This is potentially a sort of slippery slope, because once you start talking about conspiracies, you're in danger of sort of turning into David Icke and being completely mad. I think there are two naive responses to conspiracies. One of them is the extreme, which tragically we're seeing, you know, on quite a large scale in the US now, typified by QAnon, which says that, you know, President Trump is defending the US from a conspiracy of pedophiles. The other extreme is to pretend that there are no conspiracies. Now, the truth is that politics comprises lots and lots of little conspiracies. And actually, when in organizations, when people use the word politics, what they mean is people getting together offline and agreeing joint actions, which are not only to do with the benefit of the organization as a whole and its mission, but are also to do with benefiting their own groups or departments and themselves as individuals. Now, I think what we're seeing here, and we have direct evidence of this, is quite a lot of coordination. So we're not saying there is a single giant global mad conspiracy to destroy the BBC. What we are saying is that there are a number of players who, for ideological as well as political and commercial vested interests, do coordinate with each other. Actually, if you read Madsen Pirie's rather well-written book about the story of the Adam Smith Institute, he's extremely clear about this, that you had to coordinate with other people who were like-minded. You particularly coordinated with newspaper editors and journalists who were like-minded. And so the 55 Tufton Street cluster, according to someone who used to work for the Taxpayers Alliance, you know, met every, I think, week, and they would coordinate which campaigns were they going to highlight over the forthcoming period, and then made sure that they coordinated their actions. So it's a sort of conspiracy, but it's not a sort of vast global conspiracy.
What you're saying, if I'm correct, is that a small group of lobbyists, an industry in its own right, funded by invisible players who may or may not have the interests of the British public at heart, is seeking to directly influence not only British government policy, but also how that policy is reported on the BBC. Who is investigating and monitoring that situation?
Well, various people, particularly, I mean, The Guardian and The Observer, above all, have exposed quite a lot of this. So I think there's been some investigative journalism. And compared with, say, 3 years ago, I think that there's much wider awareness of the 55 Tufton Street cluster than there was 3 years ago. My hunch is that a majority of our readers in the book will be a little bit surprised at the scale of this. Certainly most people are not aware of these think tanks, but most people are reading and seeing stories which come indirectly from these think tanks. So I think that we may be in a sort of period of transition. It's on nothing like the same scale as the US. The US, big money and dark money has a huge impact in the US, and it primarily comes from billionaires. They have a sort of different system. Interestingly, you mentioned Dominic Cummings, the Prime Minister's special advisor, main advisor. What Cummings thinks about the media system we should have in the UK, including the BBC, is not a secret, because he actually wrote it in 2004, and a sidekick had a very small, a rather grandly titled think tank called the New Frontiers Foundation. He wrote some blog posts in 2004, which were exposed in January this year by The Guardian, because they were sort of still in the recesses of the internet. And essentially what he was proposing was a media ecology similar to the American one, which has given us this hugely divided nation. And the four-point plan consisted, number one, of attacking and undermining the BBC wherever possible, which of course has happened increasingly since then. Number two was that the UK should have an equivalent of Fox News. In other words, a biased right-leaning, depending on your view. I mean, the Fox News is sort of very, very right-leaning and hugely profitable, by the way. Number three would be phone-in shock jocks, who are sort of more extreme than Fox News. And number four, which is an absolute killer in my view, is absolutely no constraints on political advertising. Now, obviously, when you have no constraints on political advertising, you're creating an opportunity for anyone to spend their money on political advertising. The people who benefit are the people who are very rich. You know, so I would not be able to get very far on the amount of money I have, and nor would the great majority of people. So that is Dominic Cummings' agenda. And attacking the BBC was number one on that. At no point has he said, I've changed my mind, I was very young at the time. So we can only assume he still believes that. And what we've actually seen is more and more attempts to undermine the BBC. And we're about to see attempts to launch a UK Fox News. Now, that may not be successful, because in the UK, we have impartiality rules, not just on the BBC, but on all broadcast news. Those impartiality rules are strongly welcomed by the British public, and they are policed by Ofcom. And that is, of course, part of why it was sort of funny. Don't know how serious it was, but the idea that Paul Dacre, having now stood down from the Daily Mail, should be, you know, the ideal choice to be the next chairman of Ofcom, the regulator of impartiality, where various people have said that, I mean, he was a brilliant editor, but impartiality is not something you associate with Paul Dacre. So there is an agenda, and in the case of Dominic Cummings, it's a very explicit agenda, which he has not repudiated. So don't be surprised if what we're seeing, I think that this emerged in January. I think the current situation has changed, because the coronavirus has made people realize the importance of public services like the NHS and the BBC and trusted news. And also the coronavirus crisis has reduced the credibility of the Prime Minister and Dominic Cummings. So I think that the power has shifted. But in terms of Dominic Cummings's beliefs, I don't think there's been any change since 2004.
Let's just say the BBC is too big and too powerful. Let's just say it does need to be cut down to size a bit. The only motive I can find on a macro level that isn't to do with the free market is one that wants to dismantle democracy, one that wants to take away something which is holding the country together. Reading your book, this is the first time I've actually ever felt angry about what is happening to the BBC, because I see now clearly that an attack, an effective attack on the BBC is an effective attack on the culture and the democracy in Great Britain.
I think that's potentially the effect, but I'm much more optimistic. I think, of course, we have many other checks and balances. Now, this particular number 10 has also, of course, attacked the civil service. It's attacked Parliament. It's attacked the judiciary. It's attacked Channel 4. It's attacked newspapers it doesn't like. And the journalists from the newspapers who did support the government's line walked out. They refused to participate in this. And so Parliament is showing itself not willing, you know, increasingly, including a lot of backbenchers, increasingly unwilling to be pushed around by Dominic Cummings and Boris Johnson, particularly given the loss of credibility because the coronavirus has been so spectacularly badly. Having said that, I think you're right to be enraged about it. I think that those of us who are certainly engaged, not necessarily absolutely enraged. I think sort of rage is beyond a certain point not good for democracy, but a degree of being enraged, I think, is justified. The BBC is not the only broadcaster keeping us together. I think in particular, all the free-to-air broadcasters are keeping the country together. And that's, you know, includes the commercial public service broadcasters as well. And some of the newspapers also, we are lucky to have, you know, a range of newspapers. When you ask people first, which is the number one source you would go to for impartial news, or you ask them, what is the number one source you go to for trusted news, then despite year after year of these enemies of the BBC trying to persuade the British public not to trust the BBC, the BBC comes out easily top, and the other people that come out very high are the other broadcasters, because we do have these impartiality rules, and the British public doesn't know the details of any of this, but I think the British public has enough common sense to realise the value of these impartiality views rules, and also the public realises that despite constant claims to the contrary, the BBC and Channel 4 and ITV and Sky News, by the way, are all trusted sources. The BBC, by the way, has never been found to be inaccurate in its reporting.
After winning so many battles and being so well resourced, as you describe, how close is the anti-BBC Wehrmacht to winning the war? Because that's what it is. It's a machine that seems to be set up and industrialized to run the BBC eventually into the ground. And like you say, there's a lot of support for the BBC, but you can't ignore the fact that it's become weaker over time.
Well, the reason it's become weaker over time is because its funding has been cut so deeply. So there are various narratives against the BBC, and one of them is the BBC keeps getting bigger and ever expanding and doing things it didn't and crowding out poor Rupert Murdoch and all of that. That is simply at variance with the facts. The truth is that the BBC since 2010 was when the BBC's real public funding was at its height, and it had a very decent settlement actually from John Major. So it was a Conservative government, and that was in order to launch digital TV, radio and online services, partly to create, to give licence payers more and other benefits for the country, but also to help drive the government's digital agenda. And so it did that. Since 2010, the BBC has been getting smaller and smaller in terms of its funding. At the same time, the cost of programmes and actually the cost of distribution and technology have been getting higher, and there's more and more competition, and the market has been getting bigger. So the BBC is becoming smaller, and it's becoming much smaller within the wider market. So that whole story about an ever-expanding BBC is simply a lie. Now, it's a lie which has been repeated again and again, because some of the enemies of the BBC are sort of, they're rather Leninist. Michael Gove has a picture of Lenin as an inspiration on his office wall, allegedly. And one of the things about Leninism is if something isn't true, keep saying it, and then eventually enough people will believe it anyway. So that's one of the lies. I think that the more recent one is about the BBC being too woke. It's a very hard organisation to collaborate with. It's a very hard organisation to help. Of course, it's often infuriating. How could it not be? It's such a huge part of our lives. How could it not quite often show programmes or do things which we disagree with, all of us? And occasionally it gets things wrong. I mean, the most recent example was, Rule Britannia and Last Night of the Proms. Now, we have to be clear. First of all, the BBC didn't invent that problem that there are various sort of BLM type people and people on the left who hate the last night of the proms. I would argue they hate the last night of the proms partly because they don't look at it very closely. It is true there's a lot of flag waving, but everybody's flag is welcome. And so you try waving an EU flag at a Trump rally and see how welcome they are. I think that the last night of the proms was actually, it was patriotic without being nationalistic, if I can quote Orwell on that. Again, patriotism about love of your country, nationalism about hatred of minorities and hatred of people from other countries and so on. And if you look properly at the last night of the proms and Rule Britannia and all that, I don't think any rational person would say that was nationalistic. I think they would say it's patriotic, as is the BBC. And so they got that wrong, but they then did a U-turn. Something you have to allow for in a lot of these arguments about political correctness is that very often, where there are issues which divide the country, and of course Brexit is the ultimate one, the BBC gets criticised from both sides, whatever it does. If you say which media organisation has a weekly transgender diary, that's the Daily Telegraph. You know, a lot of this sort of accusation of wokery, reasonable people can disagree about whether it's right, but this idea that the BBC is sort of completely out on a limb and out of touch with ordinary people and everybody else is normal, that's just not the way it is.
How do you see the mission of the BBC changing under Director General Tim Davie, who successfully ran the commercial arm of the BBC, BBC Studios? Is he just managing decline now, or can we look forward to a well-funded independent BBC that everyone can be proud of?
I think he may well be managing decline simply because the forces lined up against the BBC are so powerful. And the big issue is funding. If the BBC, as I said, if the BBC still had the same real public funding as 10 years ago, it would have plenty of resources to do all the things it's now criticised for not doing. It could do more outside London. Although, by the way, it was also criticised for spending a lot of money setting up a major media centre in Salford. So classic case of getting it both ways. Part of the dilemma for BBC is it has to spend more on distribution and technology at the same time as its funding is being cut, content costs are being cut, and it needs to do more to engage younger viewers and listeners without losing its traditional, rather older audience. And the thing which is limiting its ability to do that is the funding cuts. So the main thing, in my view, that Tim Davie needs to do is to make the case for a proper independent review of the funding method, done calmly and properly and based on evidence and looking rationally at the alternatives rather than just sort of driven by the BBC's enemies. Also getting people to realise the extent of the funding cuts since 2010, and also why the BBC simply can't afford to fund free TV licences for every household with an over 75, or if it did do that, the depth of the cuts in services it would have to make. I think if and when those cuts are made, then I think the British public will be absolutely horrified, the great majority, and say, why are we doing this? Clearly, free TV licences are a welfare benefit, as they were that when they were introduced. If you're going to have them, they should be paid for out of general taxation. It really is that simple, rather than saying we're all going to have less good television and radio services.
In answering its critics, do you think that the BBC is not front foot enough, not aggressive enough in countering its criticisms? It seems to just take every punch and absorb it.
It is rather remarkable that the BBC leans over backwards not to fight its corner quite often. I have to say that if any other public service had had its public funding cut by 30% since 2010, the BBC would have covered it. But given that it's the BBC itself which has had its public funding cut so deeply, it doesn't do that. And so for those of us who are critical friends of the BBC, it can be a little bit frustrating. I have to say, I think that Tim Davie, the new Director General, is more likely to be a little bit more assertive. He himself has a conservative background. The new chairman will almost certainly also be a conservative. And I think that they together will be actually in a stronger position to argue the BBC's case than possibly their predecessors were. And I very much hope people do that.
Someone I know who knows him has said that he's up for a fight. Would you say that was an apt description?
I would say Tim Davie is up for a fight. He's a conservative, but, a sort of one nation conservative. He believes in a universal BBC. He has, of course, a very strong commercial background. And so I think he's very well placed. And from my interactions with him, I think his personality is absolutely what's needed right now to make the positive case for the BBC. The BBC will be in a much stronger position once people have a better understanding of how lucky we are to have it and how badly we'd miss it if we lost it.
And do you think it can recover from those body blows, those scandals, Saxgate, Savile? Has it become too risk-averse now for its own good?
I think the BBC does tend to be risk-averse and probably a little bit too risk-averse. I think it's very understandable that there's an element of a sort of bunker mentality because it is relentlessly attacked, both fairly and unfairly. But when it does get things wrong, then it's attacked on a massive scale. And I think that we are the poorer for it. It's a creative organisation. We wanted to take risks. By definition, if you take risks, some of them won't come off. In general, I think we should all be encouraging the BBC to take more risks. But of course, the relentless attacks have the opposite effect. I think the BBC will survive. My fear is not that it will sort of disappear overnight. If its enemies ever sort of were foolish enough to say we should abolish it, then of course there'd be a massive backlash. So I think it's more likely to suffer from, death of a thousand cuts, similar to what's happened over the last 10 years, but continuing. And the end point of that is sort of either no BBC at some point or something similar to public broadcasting in America, which is sort of really neither here nor there. It's just very, very small. I think that the enemies of the BBC are smart enough to realise that you couldn't destroy it overnight, but you might be able to destroy it slowly.
Patrick Barwise, thanks for sharing your OMI with Bookomi today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me, Rich.
Patrick's book, The War Against the BBC, How an Unprecedented Combination of Hostile Forces is Destroying Britain's Greatest Cultural Heritage and Why You Should Care, is available now. Just click on the link in the Bookomi podcast. And if you enjoyed this Bookomi podcast, follow us at Bookomi on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook or LinkedIn and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Rich Kilgariff. Stay safe, stay together. And remember, you don't know what you've got until it's gone. Bye for now.